Hello, and welcome to the Sound of Economics podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic policy think tank. I'm Sean Gibson. I'm excited to welcome for today's episode Richard Toll, professor at the Department of Economics at the University of Sussex, and Peter Willem Lemmens, who is the head of analysis at the climate policy think tank Sandbag.
Hello.
And also, we've got Georg Zachmann, a Bruegel Fellow, joining us.
Hello.
We're here to discuss Europe's energy market with reference to the various impacts of Brexit. If we could possibly start perhaps with you, Georg, to get a broad sense of the EU's internal energy market and where Brexit will put the UK in this context.
Well, the internal energy market is a complex set of rules that developed over the past decades, in which essentially is written who is producing and consuming at which price electricity, and how the corresponding market rules play out. The corresponding network codes, for example, make up for electricity about 1,000 pages, just to get an idea of the underlying complexities. And that essentially helps to make sure that if the wind is blowing in the North Sea and wind turbines offshore of Great Britain are running at full speed, that then the electricity flows directly into France and Germany, and their gas-fired power plants are switched off. So all this is running automatically thanks to the internal energy market. Now, with Brexit, it becomes more and more or less unclear what will happen to this complex set of rules, because the rules are essentially overseen ultimately by the European Court of Justice. Now, with Brexit, the UK might opt out of oversight by the European Court of Justice, then the corresponding rules would not apply anymore to the UK. And all these trading relations between the UK and the rest of the EU would have to be renegotiated, and new ways of arbitration need to be found.
So if we've highlighted the complexity of the energy market there, what might the consequences of Brexit be then for climate change targets in the EU? Perhaps come to you, Peter.
Okay, I think there are two aspects to that question. The first aspect is, what does it mean to the achievement of the targets that we already agreed on? And those are the 2030 targets. And then the second aspect is, what does it mean for any future target setting? Now, for the achievement of the targets that we already agreed on, the ones for 2030, we believe that if the UK leaves the EU, that it will be more difficult, more challenging for the remaining member states to achieve those targets. And the reason is that the UK has so far delivered an above average share of the effort, both in the EU ETS as in the effort sharing regulation, and they are expected to continue to do so after 2020 as well. To give an example, for the effort sharing regulation, the overall EU target is -30%, but the national target for the UK is -37%. So they take on an above average effort. And if that above average effort is taken out of the equation, then the other member states will have to make an additional effort to fill the gap. The question is if that's necessary. If you look at the international climate framework, it doesn't have to be necessary. UK and the EU could still decide to continue with what they call a joint fulfillment. So that means that UK and the EU would still remain under one bubble, under one target, under the Paris Agreement. That is, of course, up to the EU and the UK to decide if they want to continue that way, but they could if they would want to. But if you look at the EU targets that are enshrined in EU legislation, then we do see a need to adjust the targets and increase the efforts required by other member states.
So are you saying it might be political dynamite if the increased UK ambition needs to be distributed among EU member states? Do you see there a problem?
That's definitely going to be challenging. And then I think the best way forward is to find a way to distribute the additional effort in a way that it's evenly distributed, so that it doesn't impact certain member states disproportionately. And when it comes to the effort sharing, we see that if the Commission would have used the same methodology as they have done now, but they would just exclude the UK, then the impact on the other member states would be relatively modest. So that would be a way forward. That's the first aspect that I wanted to talk about, so achievement of the already agreed targets. Now, if you look further into the future, we see that the UK has always been one of the champions of ambitious climate targets. And so we do fear that if they're no longer part of the debate and no longer part of the negotiations, that we will see in the longer term it becoming more difficult to agree to ambitious targets. And that is a concern to us.
And there's another aspect. The UK, over the last years, has always been a net importer of emissions rights. So that means if that demand falls away, then the price of permits will go down, which of course is a concern to a lot of people in Europe. And it will stimulate less investment in renewables and in innovation and those sort of things.
If we could look specifically then perhaps at possibly the EU's emission trading system and where that where the future lies for the for that system. Be very interested to get each of your thoughts on that.
Well, the system itself is probably robust. From a European perspective, there isn't... I mean, the targets are an issue, but the system itself would work just as fine without the UK there. There would be a small transition problem that at one point one of the members steps out, you have to come up with some sort of arrangement that's probably feasible and probably small fry compared to the climate problem. Perhaps much more seriously is what would happen to UK climate policy. According to the Committee for Climate Change, 55% of UK climate policy is imported from Europe. That is, these are not homegrown regulations, but these are Brexiteers would say regulations imposed by Brussels, right? And the UK will have to come up in a relatively short time, perhaps an impossibly short time, with alternative ways of regulating its emissions. And that is problematic. The sort of the default way forward, and that comes to your question, if you look at the withdrawal bill, the draft withdrawal bill, then all EU legislation will be transposed into UK law, and that means that the UK will have a UK ETS and a British emissions trading system. And then the question is, how do you link the UK ETS to the European ETS? Do you want that? Presumably you do. As somebody remarked earlier today, the UK market will probably not be liquid enough to be viable. And there's just good reasons to link markets, because it's just better for everybody, right? Trade is mutually advantageous. The big question there, and Georg alluded to that before, is that at the moment the European ETS is overseen by the European Court of Justice, and that is a big no-no to the Brexiteers in the UK. And the question is, how do you link two systems? Who has the final decision if there's fraud or if there's disagreement about the interpretation of the rules and those sort of things? There is actually a precedent there, or there's two precedents there. One is that countries like Norway, that are not part of the EU, but are part of the EU ETS, and that bit is overseen by the EFTA court. And there's a recent agreement with Switzerland, which is ultimately overseen by the Permanent Court of Arbitration instead of the ECJ. And that is probably an easier way forward, more acceptable politically in the UK.
But one of the big issues will be an issue of timing. So we don't know yet when a final decision on Brexit regulations will be taken, and then the negotiations for example a linkage like Switzerland could take 4 or 5 years, and you will have to deal with quite complex questions on allocation, for example, because Europe needs to find it acceptable the amount of allowances that then a UK system allocates, and on the other hand, that's a sovereign decision by London on how many allowances they are willing to put on the market. So, how to at the same time generate kind of compliance with what Europe wants and fulfill this desire of sovereignty, I do not fully see.
On those points, I actually hate to say that I agree with Liam Fox and David Davis, because we start from a point where there is regulatory alignment, we start from a point where there is an agreement on emissions targets and so on and so forth. So it is not, it's not comparable to the Swiss case where one component, the European, the EU had everything in place already and the Swiss had to catch up and did they really want to and blah, 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 blah. We actually start from a position where the two sides agree. So I think this is a deal that can actually be done quickly. I think this is an exception, looking at the whole of Brexit, but this is actually a deal, I think, that can be...
So you think one can cement the future allocations in the UK system in a almost constitutional manner? So
that
we are happy with?
I mean, the UK has long-term climate targets already, up to 2050. That's longer than the EU has. And they're more stringent than what the EU would want to prescribe for the UK. So the EU would just happily accept this, I think. I don't think they would ever object to the UK targets. And the other way around, I don't think, that it would be in the interest of the UK to protest against the allocation of Bulgaria, for instance.
I think the other way around might actually be more challenging. I don't see, as the UK targets are more stringent than the EU, I don't see the EU being concerned that linking with UK would undermine the ambition level of the EU targets, but more the other way around. If the UK would link with the ETS, with the EU ETS, there's a risk that the UK system would get overflooded with imports from the EU. As long as there is a persistent surplus on the market, and there still is one, despite the reforms that were agreed right now, I think that's a bigger risk, that the UK would not be willing to link with the EU ETS as long as that system is oversupplied.
Absolutely. I mean, the EU is the dog here in the UK.
Yeah, I think we might have got it a bit twisted around. Another challenge I see is within the EU, if the UK leaves. If the UK leaves the EU ETS, then that system would have to be adjusted. You would have to have cap adjustments, but there's a whole trickle-down effect of other aspects from the EU ETS that would have to be adjusted as well. One of the consequences that come to mind right now is that the modernization fund, which entails 2% of the total cap and which was put in place to get some of the lower income member states on board with the reforms, the overall volume of that modernization fund and the overall financial value of that modernization fund would go down. And then the question is if the lower income member states will ask the richer, the higher income member states, to fill up the gap with something else. And so I think there are going to be discussions within the remaining EU 27 member states on how these adjustments to the system will have to be done. And I think that's a bigger challenge than the practicalities of ensuring that the two systems would be compatible with each other. Because, as we've said before, they start from the same starting point and they've both have had 10 years of experience with the ETS as it is now, and I don't see any strong preference from one of both sides to radically change how those two systems would work.
If we might take a moment also to consider the consequences of Brexit and all these negotiations for Ireland and Ireland's place in the EU energy system. What consequences might Brexit have for Ireland?
That's essentially a political question. So at the moment we have on the island of Ireland a completely integrated electricity market and a fairly completely integrated gas market. Liquid stuff is a bit different. Liquid energy is a bit different. The problem with the single electricity market from a Brexit perspective is that this is co-regulated by the Republic of Ireland and the devolved administration of Northern Ireland. And that agreement is eventually overseen again by the European Court of Justice. If that is a red line, then Northern Ireland essentially has to withdraw from the single electricity market, from the single gas market. And that is something, and those systems are so well integrated that it's very hard to imagine that this can happen abruptly without causing chaos and probably blackouts and years and years of proceedings in the courts, right? That is if we would have a hard and abrupt Brexit. If you read the agreement that was reached in December with its strong references to the Good Friday Agreement, then you could argue that the UK government has agreed not to do this, which then would imply that they implicitly have agreed that the European Court of Justice could oversee some of the devolved governments, and the Northern Irish government doesn't have any problems with that, as far as I know. If that is comes out, then the system proceeds as it does now, and it's very hard to come up with sort of an assessment of likelihoods or the exact consequences. I think the choice here is between accepting ECJ for this part of the UK, for this part of the economy, and then all will be fine. If not, then disentangling the Northern Irish electricity from the Republic's electricity will be to do that in a sort of an orderly way is a project of a decade, I would think, because there's a lot of physical infrastructure, but also there is a market that is created, there's convergence in the regulation, environment, frequency, capacity, and everything.
I would see a part of the issue with Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland is also the question about the role of Ireland in the European internal market, because currently Ireland is obviously connected to the internal energy market through the UK. Now, if the UK is not part of the internal energy market anymore, then Ireland would essentially be disconnected from the rest of Europe. And that would make it, on the one hand, possible for Dublin to opt out of specific Brussels rules, but it would also mean that then they don't have this regulatory anchor anymore, and that would create problems in terms of investment security, and it is entering in a period of uncertainty in that stage. So
I would not worry too much about that, because essentially the Irish government would probably not admit this, and they would probably not like me saying this, but to a great extent they're actually quite happy that Brussels makes these decisions for them, because that means that they don't have to think about it, and they don't have to hire consultants and civil servants to make these decisions. So I think that secretly the Irish are actually quite happy to be regulated by Brussels on these aspects, and I don't think they would have any reason to deviate from these rules, or any desire to deviate from these rules too much.
But even
if they can.
But if there is no objective legal rule anymore that binds them to that, then there might be interest groups in Ireland that might like to see certain deviations. So then you get it. If there's a possibility, then you get a political discussion.
But at the same time, most of these companies are multinationals, and they would just like to have the same rules everywhere. Why would they want to make an exception for the part of the company that works in Ireland? So I don't see that as a big deal. And then again, the other thing that is of course on the horizon is an interconnector between France and Ireland. And then they're immediately back within the European regulations. Not that it makes much sense to build an interconnector between France and Ireland. You would just want to draw the interconnector over England and Wales, right? That's much, much cheaper. But in the event that there is an interconnector that goes underwater, then Ireland would be back in the regulatory system.
Well, I think that about wraps things up for this episode of the podcast. Big thank you to my guests, Richard, Peter, and of course Georg. And thank you to you for listening to The Sound of Economics. If you're interested in more of Bruegel's work, we have a range of blogs and papers written by our scholars available at our website, www.bruegel.org. I hope you'll join us again for The Sound of Economics. See you next time.